Hello, and welcome to the Dinner Agenda. This is Bo.
And this is CeeLo.
Hello, CeeLo.
How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Kind of.
Uh-oh.
How are you? Yeah. No. How are you, by the way, first?
I'm awesome.
Okay.
Yep. So good.
Here's the deal. My husband and I are talking about renovating our main floor.
Oh, my lordy.
It is stressing the fuck out of me because there's just so much to think about. And I've never done these kinds of renovations before.
Yeah.
And I'm like, every time I have to make a decision on something, I'm like, oh, is it the right decision? Oh my God, maybe it's not the right decision. Like, I'm like totally freaking out about it. Do I do light hardwood floors? Do I do dark colored hardwood floors? Do I even do hardwood floors? Do I do luxury vinyl, which is like the biggest thing right now, right? Like,
I think you should bring shag carpeting, orange shag carpeting. Bring back the 70s.
Listen, my parents used to have an orange and yellow, kind of like a leopard colored shag carpet in the basement with wood paneling on the walls. I remember that. Do you remember that?
I was going to say, I think I remember orange carpet in your basement. Yeah. I don't remember it being leopardy, but yeah.
Yeah, it was leopardy. It was leopardy. And we actually watched a porn with some of the high school boys in my basement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Remember? And did we even talk about this in high school flashback? The fact that they were all laying on their tummies for obvious reasons.
No.
I remember shit like that. Don't ask me what I like did yesterday, but I remember stuff like that.
Me too. Anyways. So how are you and what's going on with you?
I'm good. I thought I would give a bit of an update on the poker table situation.
Oh, yes.
Because we hadn't, like, Mel hadn't said too much about, you know, whatever auction thing she was looking at. It was all quiet. And then all of a sudden, my bro stops by with like a backseat full of purchases she's made. And I'm like, what the fuck is all this stuff? What is this stuff? So the front hall has like a bag, two bags and two boxes, I think, of stuff, right?
Wait, like, but where did she go?
It's online. It's the online auction where she
got that. So she had to go pick it up.
It's up in Barrie. So my brother brought it here for her.
Okay. Still your fucking fault, but yeah, okay.
I know. And I will live through this pain for the rest of my life. However, she says to me, oh, it's good. Like, I got some really good. I got a box of poker chips for the poker table. And I was like,
you guys have poker chips already.
That's my fucking point. I said, don't you remember that big silver case that weighs like 80 pounds with like
that a we use every
poker
time
set?
Yes.
That we have.
Yes.
We have that. Mm-hmm. Oh, I kind of forgot about that. I'm like, you think? And then she goes, oh, we'll take it up. We'll take it up north. I'm like, we fucking have poker chips up north too. We have poker chips. And then when I look again at what's sitting in the front hall, there's two boxes. And I said, you didn't get just one set. You bought two new sets of poker chips because they were a good deal. So I have poker chips now, which is awesome. And the other thing that I wanted to tell you about was, I think I was in a meeting the other day and I was touching my chin and feeling my little whiskers there. And I thought, we didn't even talk about chin whiskers. And oh my God, I feel old.
We didn't. That's right. We didn't.
Right?
What the fuck is up with chin hairs?
Facial
and why?
I
would like to know why this happens to us women. I really do. Like, why? First of all, we have to go through the whole getting your fucking period, which is shitty as it is, right?
Total shit.
Like, why do we have to go through all of that? And we have to get it once a fucking month. And then when you get the luxury of it finally stopping and you having the freedom of not, you know, then you get all these other freaking things. Like, you can't sleep. You've got fucking chin hair.
Now you can have a goatee.
Hair. Oh, we didn't even talk about hair loss. That's another fucking one. Okay, we're putting this on the podcast. We're on an episode.
You lose hair on your head, but you gain it on your chin where you've always wanted it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, so I thought that was a big miss on our part to not talk about chin hair in our, oh my God, I feel old episode.
Okay. Maybe we can record a video of you like plucking your chin hair or something, something entertaining for
them. I don't think that would be that entertaining, to be honest.
It would crack me the fuck up though. So
yeah. You would be the only one laughing. And I can't see them. I can't see them anymore.
They're so light. Huh? Yeah. You can just feel them.
I can feel them. And then when I go into the mirror, I need to put my bifocals on to see them. And it's just a clusterfuck.
Do you think we're going to end up needing diapers, CeeLo, one day?
One day. One day soon, man. Come on. My bladder was always bad. Never mind after birthing two kids. Jesus. I'm going to be in a bladder end of this year. I'm predicting it. I'm just going to call it.
Okay. Okay. I won't make fun
around,
of you.
It'll be like a lot. You're going to turn around and be like, what's that noise? I'll be like, nothing.
Oh my God. I will totally make fun of you every fucking single chance I get. It is my honor to do so.
I'll steal your fucking cane if you make fun of my diaper.
I'm not using a cane anymore. I have knee injections now, which is the other thing we didn't talk about. Okay. Yeah. We might need to do an, oh my God, I feel old.
Yeah.
Part two. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So tell me, what is on the agenda today?
Oh my gosh. We have a very special guest today. Mm-hmm. We have Dr. Tyler here, who's going to talk to us a little bit about sleep and insomnia.
Oh, perfect. Okay. So why don't I introduce Dr. Tyler?
Okay.
Give you his bio, and then we'll link in with him. So Dr. Tyler Tulloch is a clinical health psychologist and a member of the College of Psychologists of Ontario. He is also an assistant professor part-time at McMaster University in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurosciences. As a health psychologist, he works frequently with people living with chronic health conditions, helping them to better manage their health, and this work often involves treating insomnia. For his dissertation at Toronto Metropolitan University, he led a pilot study treating insomnia in people living with HIV. He has led workshops training other healthcare professionals to treat insomnia using cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, and that is the current gold standard treatment for insomnia. Dr. Tyler's contribution today is for information only, and it does not constitute a professional therapeutic relationship with the listeners or actual treatment for insomnia. So welcome. We are so happy to have you, Dr. Tyler.
Thank you very much. It's really nice to be here. I've been enjoying your podcast.
Oh, great. Great.
I feel like after that intro, we need to like find a clap reel, because that's like, woo,
yeah.
Well,
oh, yeah.
There we go. So cool. Awesome. So I have a question for you. What got you into the study of insomnia specifically? Like, what was the draw there?
Yeah, well, actually, I was studying clinical psychology. I was doing my PhD at the time it was Ryerson, now Toronto Metropolitan University. And I was in the HIV prevention lab. And for my dissertation, I was looking at study ideas. And I had some experience doing treatment in the sleep and depression lab at TMU, and had gotten really interested in treating insomnia. So cognitive behavioral insomnia, it's actually a really effective treatment. And it's a fun treatment to provide, because people really do get better with it.
Really?
There's obviously no guarantees with therapy, but it works really well. Like, I'd say it's one of the most effective therapies that I've used for treating anything. It just works really well a lot of the time.
The cognitive behavioral therapy, the CBT, that's what you're saying?
Specifically for insomnia. So it's a really good, the treatment's packaged in a way that it really, really effectively does treat insomnia. So it's just a joy to provide, because it's really nice to see your patients doing well and improving. Sometimes after only one session. Sometimes it takes longer. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And so anyway, I really wanted to incorporate that into my work in the HIV prevention lab.
Oh, that's
cool. So what I did.
Yeah.
What I did was I combined the two topics. So I took the work that I was doing with HIV research and combined it with the clinical work that I was getting through the sleep and depression lab, and kind of melded them together. And so what I wanted to do was to see whether CBT for insomnia was just as effective at treating insomnia in people living with HIV as it was in the general population. because up to date, people living with HIV had been excluded from treatment studies for insomnia because it was unclear what role the virus played in the brain and whether these people would benefit in the same way from this type of treatment. So the idea was, if we could show that it was effective in treating insomnia for these people, it could provide more access to this type of treatment across the board. So that was the idea behind the project.
So, you know, it's funny. So I was going to actually ask you a question about insomnia, which I will, but it just with what you were saying, is there an actual correlation between depression and insomnia?
I'm not sure off the top of my head what the correlation is, but yes, and it's bidirectional. So people who are depressed often kind of disengage from life and they do less and less as they kind of hibernate and kind of draw within themselves. And spending too much time at home or spending too much time lying in bed can bring on insomnia. So people who are depressed often then do develop insomnia. And the opposite happens. So when people have insomnia, obviously it's very disruptive to their daily life, and it can lead to more difficulties with work or with family members, which can lead to depression as well. So one can certainly lead to the other. I don't know off the top of my head what the statistic is, but I'll get it to you and maybe you can...
Sure. No, I'm just really curious about that because I do suffer from depression and... I think I also suffer from insomnia sometimes. So that's why I was just like, oh, I didn't realize when you had mentioned that. I thought, oh, geez, maybe there is a correlation to that. So yeah, that's very interesting. But what is, if you can help us understand what insomnia really is, like how would you define insomnia? Because sometimes, I mean, Cielo and I were talking earlier before we started recording with you. And, you know, we talk about the trouble that we have sometimes, right? Sleeping, but we don't know what's classified as insomnia or not.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's insomnia as in insomnia disorder versus insomnia, how we all just kind of talk about when we have a bad night. Right. And the prevalence is different. So about 6 to 10% of adults have clinically significant insomnia, like insomnia disorder, versus 33 to 40% of adults report some insomnia symptoms, which might not meet the diagnostic criteria for insomnia disorder, but that they would say, I have trouble with my sleep. So it's a pretty big problem across the board. So in terms of like what is actual insomnia disorder to be diagnosed with it, usually according to the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, there has to be, first of all, dissatisfaction with sleep quantity or quality, as defined by at least one of these three things. So either difficulty initiating sleep at the beginning of the night, difficulty maintaining sleep throughout the night, or having an early morning awakening without being able to return to sleep. So one of these three things has to be present, and it also has to lead to clinically significant distress or impairment. So the person has to either be really bothered by this or it has to be getting in the way in some way. So if somebody said, I have trouble falling asleep almost all the time, but it's no big deal, I don't care, I still live my life, we wouldn't diagnose them with insomnia disorder. And in terms of frequency, usually to diagnose it, it has to happen at least 3 nights a week or more, and has had to have happened for at least 3 months or more. And you wouldn't diagnose somebody who met all these criteria, but it's because, say, they were doing shift work. Let's say they were a nurse or working in a plant or something like that, and they didn't have a chance to sleep because maybe they worked all night and came home and had to take care of kids. So really, you'd only diagnose insomnia if this was all happening in the context of them having all the time they needed to actually get the sleep if they could.
Interesting. I find that whole question of how is whatever symptom, in this case insomnia, impacting your life and what difference is it making on you? So it's like, oh, well, my foot hurts. Well, is it bugging you all the time? Is it impacting? Are you stopping walking because of it? I find that doctors are asking that question a lot more now than I think in the past. So I think that's pretty, pretty interesting in how things have changed there. I feel like I'm trying to think if I've ever felt, I'm sure there's times in my past where I felt like I've had insomnia where I haven't been sleeping, but I don't know if it's been like a chronic type of thing. It's just more, you know, it happens here and there. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the myths are around it, like what's normal versus what's not so normal?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. A lot of times people will like will come in thinking that they have insomnia, but after a bit of initial discussion, they realize that what they're experiencing is pretty normal. So especially if you have a partner that falls asleep right away. So sometimes you get these people that they put their head on the pillow and within 2 minutes they're out like a light. Asshole. And so if you're if one of these types of people is your partner and you see this and you think, my God, it's taking me like 20 minutes to fall asleep, what's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. But that's actually perfectly normal. So it's perfectly normal to take anywhere really up to 30 minutes to fall asleep. So our brains have to kind of disengage and transition from being awake to being asleep. And there's certainly things that you can do to make that transition easier, like by not doing any kind of effortful activities before bed or not preparing for the next day. So trying not to be doing anything that activates your mind too much in the half hour leading to bed can help. Taking about 20 minutes to fall asleep is really, really normal and healthy. If you're falling asleep in less than 10 minutes, that's actually a sign that you're sleep deprived and not getting enough sleep.
So it's not
actually good. Yeah. Our goal is never to have people fall asleep within 5 minutes. That's a sign of unhealthy sleep as well. So not insomnia, but that's a sign that someone's sleep deprived and they need to be getting more sleep.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That's interesting. So just with what Sila was just talking about, what you had mentioned something as well earlier about, waking up in the middle of the night or waking up early in the morning and not being able to get back to sleep again. Okay. Yeah, so that happens to me all the motherfucking time, all the time. And it's been since, I'm going to say it's been really, really since menopause, I would say probably, that's been happening. And, so I find that when I'm going to sleep within 10 minutes, I'm like out. Whereas my husband is like, you know, a little bit longer, but that's interesting that that means I might actually be sleep deprived.
Yeah.
Never thought
I would say
that.
10. Yeah. 10 minutes, not bad. But if it's like 5 minutes, if it's usually under 10 minutes, you think about trying to get a little bit more sleep on a nightly basis.
I was watching a reel on Instagram yesterday and it was a narcoleptic golden doodle. And it's this dog really like playing around. And all of a sudden it's like, crash, and his whole head would like kind of hit the ground and he would be asleep sometimes with his butt in the air. I'm like, I was kind of laughing. I was laughing at it, and then I'm like, oh, that's kind of sad. And then I kind of felt a little bit jealous about the ability to sleep like that. I don't fall asleep that quickly. I do find out though, the 3 a.m. wake up and not being able to get back to sleep is typically I call that red wine induced.
If I've had drinks
sometimes I'll wake up, you know, you don't get a restful sleep, wake up at 3 a.m can't get back to sleep after that, feel like maybe I need to go put my mouth under the faucet and drink a whole bunch of water.
because you can't go downstairs and get a glass, like are you 12?
No, well, I have cups. I said that because it's like you feel so thirsty if you've had a few drinks, right? So it's just okay.
Yeah, and that's a good point. A lot of people use alcohol because they think that it's going to help them to sleep, and they use it specifically as a sleep aid, because what alcohol does, it relaxes you and it kind of relaxes your mind before bed. So people may actually be able to loosen up and unwind and feel less anxious and fall asleep a little better. Yeah. But like you're saying, it gets in the way during the night.
Yeah.
So it really prevents your brain from getting good quality sleep, and it keeps you in a lighter stage of sleep all night long and more likely to wake up throughout the night and not get the restful sleep.
Yeah.
So it
definitely makes a difference falling asleep though, for sure.
So, Dr. Tyler, I hear a lot of things in the media about the amount of sleep that you're supposed to be getting, right? 8 to 9 hours or whatever it is. Is that true? Is that not true? Like, what are your thoughts on what people should be getting?
Yeah, I mean, say yes and no. So you hear a lot that there's this benchmark, like you've got to get your 8 hours of sleep a night, every night, to get a good sleep. And I think that that does more harm than good, because not everybody can sleep 8 hours a night. Everybody is built differently. Some people are, you know, shorter sleepers. They might sleep six and a half, 7 hours a night. Some are longer sleepers. They might need 9 or 10 hours to feel refreshed. And everybody's different. So if you take somebody who is, say, a 6 or even a 5 hour sleeper all their life and tell them there's something wrong with you because you're not getting your 8 hours, that's going to start causing a lot of problems. So, you know, worrying about the fact that what's going to happen to me or my health if I'm not getting 8 hours of sleep, and then that suddenly can trigger insomnia as you're, yeah, as you're more worried about your sleep. Sleep is certainly something that you can't force. So, one concept we talk about is sleep effort. When people feel like they're putting effort into falling asleep, then that almost always backfires, because sleep is the kind of thing that happens when you let go. It's kind of like, do you remember those finger traps from the 80s where you would stick your fingers in
each
and
side?
If you pulled your finger, yeah, yeah, if you tried to pull your fingers apart, you'd be trapped forever. So the, yeah, only way to get out of the trap is to let go of the struggle and to kind of give up trying to pull your fingers apart. And then when you let go of the struggle, then it happens. So that's really a good metaphor for how we can approach falling asleep. So anytime you're doing something that you feel is you're putting an effort to try to make sleep happen, really all you're doing is ensuring that sleep's not going to happen. So really it happens when you let go of all of that.
So, okay, that is really, really interesting that you're saying this. So would your recommendation be, like, if I was, so I mentioned to you that my big issue here is, like, so it's not falling asleep, but it's like clockwork, waking up at 3:30 in the morning, and then can't fall back asleep again. Right. So, and then there are some evenings where it's like, I do feel like I'm focused too much on falling asleep because I've got a big day the next day. And I'm like, you know, the stress of wanting to get a good sleep kind of makes me not have a good sleep. Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, if in those situations where it's like you're tossing and turning, tossing and turning, tossing and turning, would your recommendation be to wait it out, like keep lying there and wait it out? Or do you get up? Or what's your recommendation? What do we do?
Yeah, always get up. So if you're awake and it's been maybe 5 or 10 minutes and you're still in a bit of a sleepy state, stay in bed. But if it's to the point where you feel like you're absolutely awake and you're not about to fall asleep in the next little while, or it's been like 15, 20 minutes, always get out of bed. The reason for that is, so it takes us back to the Russian scientist Pavlov. I don't know if you guys remember anything about Pavlov and the dogs.
I do, yeah.
Okay, so it kind of goes back to that concept of classical conditioning. So what Pavlov did, he would feed the dogs, and when he presented the food to the dogs would salivate. Just like if you gave me a piece of pizza, we're talking about the best cheese slice in North America.
That's later right.
On. yeah. So if you were to give me a slice of pizza, and even as I'm thinking about that pizza, right now I'm salivating. I can tell
me too. Me too, Dr. Tyler. Pizza after this. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a natural response. So yeah, the stimulus of food causes the response of salivating. So what Pavlov did, he rang a bell every time the dogs got food and found that after a while, all he had to do was ring a bell and the dogs would salivate. Now, if you rang a bell for you or me, we wouldn't salivate. It would be really, really unusual. But if we rang a bell every time we were presented with pizza, then it would happen to us as well. So the way that works, with our sleep is that when we're doing too many things that aren't sleep related in bed specifically, but also in our bedroom in general, our bedroom becomes conditioned as a place that triggers alertness and triggers awakeness. So eventually we don't need to have a problem that we're trying to solve in the bedroom. We don't need to necessarily have a sleepless night anymore in the bedroom. We don't need to be doing homework or reading or preparing for the next day in the bedroom anymore, because once we've done that enough times, the bedroom, simply by existing, the bedroom itself starts to trigger all of that anxiety and worry and discomfort and tension within us. So what people find is when they have insomnia, they might feel perfectly sleepy on a sofa, and then as soon as they step into their bedroom, even if it's still dark, then suddenly it's like a light switch and their brain turns on and they're wide awake again. Because the bedroom has become a trigger for alertness and tension. Similarly, these people, if they go to stay in a hotel or they're staying at a friend's house, they might sleep perfectly fine and their insomnia goes away. But when they come back home and they're in their own bedroom, the insomnia is there waiting for them. It's because they've been we call it conditioned arousal. So they become conditioned to be aroused in the bedroom.
There's so many things I want to say to that right now. Yeah, exactly.
I am not that kind of podcast, okay, Dr. Okay. Tyler. Okay.
So I have a question for you, because I want to go back to what you were talking about when you were talking about being sleep deprived. So, okay. So my story on this is, how do you know if you're sleep deprived when you just always feel fucking tired?
because you're always running, going, doing, right? Like busy. The kids keep me crazy busy. House keeps me busy. Work keeps me busy. And I always feel tired. I always feel like I'm yawning. I feel like I'm exhausted. And so how do you kind of differentiate between what's kind of normal given my current life situation versus not getting enough sleep? Like, how do you tell the difference?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'll start by pointing out that you just used the T word, tired, which I never like to use because it's too vague. So especially when you're working in sleep and also working with chronic health issues, which I do, tired can mean so many different things. So I always like to clarify. So tired can mean sleepy, tired can mean fatigued, or it could just mean like a combination of both. So sleepiness and fatigue are really two completely separate things that can certainly coexist. But when someone says they're tired, they could mean any of them. So if someone is sleepy, if you were to put them in a dark, quiet room and make them comfortable and kind of close the door and leave them alone, they would fall asleep. If someone was just fatigued, they wouldn't. So their body would be physically exhausted. They would have no energy. They wouldn't feel like doing anything. They'd be dragging their feet around all day. But if you were to put them in a quiet, dark bedroom, they wouldn't fall asleep because they're not sleepy. So really that would be the key difference, is how likely would you be to like nod off and fall asleep? If you would say not at all, like, you know, I feel so exhausted, but I wouldn't actually sleep if I was given the chance, then I would say it's probably more fatigue than sleepiness.
Got it. I feel like that's like the classic difference between tired and sick and fucking tired.
Okay, question. I keep hearing this phrase, sleep hygiene. What the hell is sleep hygiene?
So those are like sleep rules. So rules to kind of, it's like, how do you clean up your sleep habits? And sleep hygiene tips are actually really, they can be really helpful for people that don't have insomnia disorder. But once your sleep problem has escalated to the point of it being insomnia and happening all the time, then sleep hygiene won't really do much for it. So sleep hygiene are things like following healthy sleep rules, like don't use your electronics half an hour before bedtime. Don't use your electronics in the bedroom at all. Like, keep the bedroom just for sleeping.
How is that possible, though? Can anybody do that? But sure, maybe.
Okay. I have heard people are like reverting back from, like, instead of using your phone as your alarm clock, because then your phone is on your nightstand right next to you, it's just too easy. People are now going and buying just a regular old alarm clock and plugging their phone in the kitchen and leaving it out of the bedroom. Yeah.
Huh,
just to avoid the you know, that draw it has.
So I guess TVs would fall under that too, right? Like, don't have TV. Okay, damn. Okay.
It would, yeah. And that's for the reason we talked about the idea of the classical conditioning, like with Pavlov, right? So in treating insomnia, one of our rules is leave the bedroom just for sleep and sex. So those are the two activities you can do in your bedroom. Everything else, if it can be at all helped, should always happen outside the bedroom. So at nighttime when you're coming to bed, usually you'd wait until you're feeling sleepy, like your eyes are wanting to close, your head's nodding, and then you can get into the bedroom. Never come into the bedroom and get into bed wide awake, hoping that sleep will come later. So leave all wakefulness even outside of the bedroom. So only come to bed once your sleepiness has kind of hit you.
So that's interesting, because I'm suspecting now that I might actually have an issue with sleep now that we're talking, but I do have a TV in the bedroom, and I do sometimes feel, I know Cilo's shaking her head, but I do. And I sometimes feel anxious about sleeping. Like, you know, I put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure that I, you know, get upstairs to the bedroom at the same time each night and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I find that if I just go into my bed and try to sleep, which is kind of what you were just saying, then I find I'm not able to. So what I will do is I'll put the TV on. And my thing right now, Dr. Tyler, is Forensic Files, right? So I put Forensic Files on because the guy's voice is so like monotone. It's like, and then she came in and murdered her husband. And you know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff. And it just makes me like lull off. And so I just kind of listen to it in the background while my eyes are closed. And then I kind of lull off. But what you're saying though, is that's probably not a good thing to do. Or is it a good thing to do? I don't know. Right? Like
when I'm treating insomnia, It really depends on what I feel is driving the insomnia for the person. So if I feel like one of the main things driving someone's insomnia is the fact that their bedroom has become paired with all of these wakeful activities, yeah. mm-hmm. then I would say absolutely not, like, stop that altogether. Mm-hmm. But for people whose insomnia is being driven by somebody else, and for whom, when they're in bed, if they can distract themselves a little bit with something to kind of take their mind off of problems and let sleepiness return, then it's not the end of the world. So if for you, I mean, if that part's working, then it sounds like that's not part of the problem.
Now we know why she's waking up at 3 a.m. though. It's to turn off the fucking TV. That's what's happening.
That could be. That could be. Do you have it on a timer?
No. Maybe I should. Listen, that's not, I understand that. Maybe it is why I'm waking. I don't know, guys. I don't know. I'm going to have to investigate this one. That's for sure. That's interesting though, because it's been since menopause though, this whole 3:30 in the morning, it's like flipping clockwork, 3:30 AM every morning. Why? And I can get back to sleep sometimes, but I would say probably once or twice every 2 weeks, I'm like, I'm up. I cannot get back to sleep. So I just wake up, I go downstairs, I make a coffee, you know, look on Facebook for a little bit. Sometimes I'm able to fall back asleep again at maybe 5 a.m. or 5:30.
3:30 in the morning and then you go make a fucking coffee?
Dude, if I'm not sleeping, if I cannot get back to sleep, I say to myself, you know what? I'm waking up.
I'm doing my morning routine. And
yep, that's it. I get up and then I say to myself, if I feel tired, I'll go back to sleep. If I don't, then I'm getting on with my day. That's what I do, yeah. Right?
Okay.
So obviously
I mean, that part's not a bad idea. I mean, 3:30 does sound early, but it depends mm-hmm. on your usual. If usually you wake up at 5, 3:30 is not that big of a stretch. But if you're like me and you're a night owl and you like to wake up at 8 or 9, then 3:30 mm-hmm. is almost like closer to my bedtime than my wake up time. So I could mm-hmm. never do it.
Yeah. No.
Is your coffee decaf? Do you have decaf when you wake up at that time of the night?
Are you for real, Tyler? No, it's caffeine. It's like normal coffee. Like I brew it.
That's interesting, you know, because I've found that in the past, in my younger years, I could have had a mm-hmm. coffee after dinner. I could have had food late, like no problem at all. And now it like noon hits and somebody's like, do you want to go grab a coffee? I'm like, fuck no. Are you crazy? Not happening. I will lie in bed and I will be wide awake, almost like jittery. And this is like many hours later if I had had that afternoon coffee. Actually, that makes me think of one other thing, that restless leg. Have you had any of you know, when you're lying in bed and I feel like all of a sudden I almost got the jitters where I can't, you know, I can't get comfy, can't stop moving.
Yeah. Restless leg. Yeah. Restless leg syndrome. I think a lot of us experience it from time to time without us having like the disorder.
Yeah.
I hate it. I have it from time to time. And I think it depends, like if I've been doing a lot of running and my legs are kind of worn out a little bit, or if I'm sleep deprived and I've been staying up too late, I notice it gets worse.
Yeah.
But it's awful because you can't fall asleep when your legs are in that state. So for me, I sometimes give it like 2 or 3 different jitters. And then if it doesn't go away on its own, then I just get out of bed because I know that it's going to be one of those nights where every 5 minutes as I'm drifting off, my legs are going to act up and I'm going to wake up anyway. So I just go and do something else for 30 or 40 minutes and then try it again.
And then try it again. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. And that doesn't wake you up like by getting up and just, well, I guess it might, but I guess it's taking the pressure off, right?
Yeah. And I'm up anyway. Like I'm not falling asleep because mm-hmm. of the restless leg. So if I'm up anyway, like I was saying, if you're up, if you're going to be up anyway, if you're not falling mm-hmm. asleep, if it's not on the horizon, then get out of bed and do something else.
Yeah.
Well,
that's why I was, you know, the judgment from CeeLo over there, I'm going to smack her in a minute. But you know, that is why I do when I'm struggling that way. Like if I get up at 3:30 and I'm awake and I'm lying in bed for half an hour and now it's 4 a.m. and I'm like, look it, you know, it's not happening. Yeah. I don't want to stress myself out more by sitting at, which is why I just get up and do my morning routine. There are occasions where by around 5:30 or 6, I'm starting to feel sleepy again. So I'll go, like I'm on the sofa and I'll just like lie down and have another sleep for about an hour. And then I feel great afterwards. Okay. But Yeah, I'm trying to remove myself from that situation. So it kind of sounds a little bit like that's the right thing to do, but then also maybe I should consider not making a caffeinated coffee.
I would say don't make the caffeinated coffee. Yeah.
All right. Maybe have like a, as long as the
point. If you like tea, have a herbal tea.
Yeah, herbal caffeine. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if the plan is to try and nod off again or have a little snooze, yeah, then I would skip the coffee. Although, yeah, okay. I don't know. It's just made such a difference. What about other things like to help sleep, right? I hear a lot about melatonin and people giving their kids melatonin or sometimes
magnesium
or Benadryl. I'm kidding. I would never do that.
I think that's a
don't do that.
And, but I did. I was working with this awesome personal trainer at one point, and she had suggested a really good magnesium, not necessarily to help me fall asleep, but to make sure that my sleep was more restful and that I was staying asleep. And I did find that that did help me stay. I did feel more well rested when I got up in the morning when I was doing it, when I was taking them regularly.
Would you take that the night just before you went to bed?
Yeah, it's like an hour before you go to bed to take it. And so I'd like take it at 9, head up to bed around 10. And I like I said, it didn't help me to fall asleep at all. But when I woke up in the morning, I did feel like I was better rested, you know, that I had slept through. I get up to pee anyway, so there's that. But that's a whole other fucking show.
Magnesium, I actually... Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't really speak to that at all. Melatonin, it's one of those things where you probably have to be a little extra careful. I know you can buy it off the shelf, but if you use melatonin wrong, it can really mess up your sleep. So you want to be careful with how you use it. For people with insomnia disorder, melatonin is not a cure for that. Mm-hmm. So it's not really going to help, because with insomnia disorder, what the problem often is just a really active mind and having a hard time shutting the mind off. So melatonin isn't really going to do a whole lot. So someone with insomnia can get really, can feel sleepy, but if your mind activates, it can kind of push away the sleepiness for a while. And if there's a lot of tension in your body, if you're feeling really strong emotions, that's going to override your sleepiness for a period. And you have to find ways to manage the kind of the strong emotions that you might be experiencing, whether it's anxiety or feeling down or worried, feeling angry. So if you can manage the emotions and minimize kind of the intensity of those emotions, and or if there's a really active mind, if you can find ways to calm the mind, that usually allows that sleepiness to come back to the surface and let you pop back into bed.
How do you calm the mind though? Like, how is it like a, like, would you suggest like meditation apps or like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing is, there's different ways. So one way is distraction. So typically what I recommend at first, if you're not able to fall asleep or not able to get back to sleep and you have to leave the bedroom, as we're saying, so that you're breaking that connection between the bedroom and that internal tension. So get out of the bedroom, first of all, and then do something that's going to shift the focus of your attention or calm the mind down. So if somebody is, you know, really worried about life problems or stressed out about what's going to happen the next day, there's other more specific tools that we can use for that. But one easy way to start off is by, you know, put something on TV that you enjoy, that you've seen before, and that's not going to hook you into watching a full length movie or multiple episodes. So one thing I don't recommend if you can't sleep and getting up at night is, say, scrolling social media, because there's no end to that. You'll just do it forever, no matter how tired you are. I should have said sleepy. No matter how sleepy you are. But if you put on, say, even if you're reading a book, but it's like a murder mystery and it's a page turner and you can't put it down, that's not going to help you. If you're watching a movie and it's a thriller or a mystery and you want to see how the show ends, that's not going to help you. But if you put something on you've already watched or that is relatively kind of non-stimulating, then that is the kind of thing that can bring that sleepiness back to the surface, because it pushes away the concerning thoughts as you're focused on something different, and then the sleepiness can come back.
Okay, so that's funny that you say that, because I mentioned Forensic Files before because of the guy's voice. I know, I'm telling you, it works. Even my husband says it works. But also, just a tip, Downton Abbey. if you put Downton Abbey on, because it's not a super stimulating show, right? Like, it's interesting. Like, I love the show. It's one of my favorites. But, you know, it's calm. Their accents are lovely. They talk quiet. They're very proper. So it's just, you know, it's very, and it's such a great show to fall asleep to. Just letting you know.
It's funny. I don't have a TV in the bedroom for that reason, because I feel like it would just stay on. I'd have to wake up to turn it off. Like, it would just be bad news. Well, and then the other thing is, wifey, I go to bed at 10. She stays on the sofa watching a show or two, often falls asleep on the sofa, and then comes up to bed at God knows what time. And I'm like, that's so not good for you. You need to turn that off. You need to come up to the bed, like, not necessarily as early as I do, because we are on a little bit different schedule. But, and, you know, instead of falling asleep to something, I feel like it's not good.
Okay, well, then if, okay, so that's, I hear your point there, CeeLo. So, Dr. Tyler, what do you recommend then? Like, in terms of what should people start to consider doing to have
like good routines almost?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I recommend is to build your sleep drive. So there's really two main processes that control our sleepiness and when we get sleepy. One is sleep drive and one is our circadian rhythm or our internal clock. So for sleep drive, you can think of sleep like a drive, like hunger or thirst. So if you've just had a nice big meal, there's nothing you can do to make yourself hungry except let time go by without eating. So the more time that goes by without having something to eat, or if you've, you know, if you're not thirsty anymore, you'll only get thirsty if you go a certain length of time without having more to drink, right? So sleep is the same thing. You're not going to get sleepy unless you've had enough time not sleeping. So one of the recommendations is cut out napping. So naps are wonderful. I had a nap yesterday, even in the evening, and that technically should have gotten in the way of my sleep. Fortunately, it didn't. But we never recommend napping in the evenings or even the afternoon. So if you're going to have a nap, have it maybe in the early part of the day and try to limit it to about 30 minutes. Napping, it's kind of like having a snack before a big meal. So if you're going over to a relative's house for, say, Thanksgiving dinner, you're not going to go through the McDonald's drive-through on your way there like a half hour before the meal, right? You're just not going to be hungry and you're not going to enjoy the meal. So same with sleep. If you want to get a nice, good quality sleep, you're not going to want to take like a sleep nap, like a sleep snack, which is a nap relatively close to bedtime. It's just gonna make your sleep lighter and less fulfilling. So building your sleep drive is important. You can do that by cutting out your napping. You can do that by being physically active. So the more you move around during the day, the more sleep drive you're going to build. So if somebody goes for, say, a 30, 40 minute walk during the day, they may be that much sleepier at bedtime than if they didn't go for that walk. If someone has a nap, especially like a 1 or 2 hour nap, and imagine if it's later in the day, you're really zapping your sleep drive so that when bedtime rolls around, you're either going to take longer to fall asleep, or you're going to fall asleep and wake up during the night, or get a lighter sleep and less fulfilling sleep. So doing anything you can to increase your sleep drive and get yourself nice and sleepy at bedtime is important. So Bo, you said if you wake up at 3:30, sometimes you just stay up for the rest of the day. So that's not a bad idea if you're thinking about in terms of building your sleep drive for the next night, because you're awake for a long time if you wake up at 3:30 instead of your usual wake up time. So you're going to be even sleepier the next night. So you can't do that too many times in a row without your sleep eventually catching up to you and being able to kind of catch up on sleep.
How important is it to keep to like a schedule where you're, you know, 10 p.m. off to bed, 6 a.m. up from bed, like to keep that going, even like over the weekend, let's say?
Yeah, I'd say that's really important. So that's that second process that affects our sleep, which is the circadian rhythm or the internal clock. So all of us as humans have about an internal clock that operates on about a 24-hour schedule. It affects when certain hormones are released in the body that determine when we're hungry, when our hunger gets shut off, when we're sleepy or when we're alert. It impacts our core body temperature as well. So it's usually triggered by light. So blue spectrum light, which is the type of light that comes from the sun, but also from our devices. So when we're going about our day, there's a lot of light in our environment, typically from the sun. And as the sun sets, there's less blue light coming into our eyes from the outdoors. And when we get less blue light, our brain registers that and says, nighttime is approaching. I got to prepare this person's body for sleep. So we're going to start lowering the person's body temperature. We're going to change what hormones are being released. And our bodies love consistency. So if you were falling asleep and waking up at similar times 7 days a week, your body is going to love that and thank you. From what we've been talking about, like, it's clear we can't just shut our brains off and fall asleep at the same time every night. That's beyond our control. What we can physically control is what time we're getting up every morning. So generally we start with wake ups. So if you want to standardize your bedtimes and wake times, you're going to want to start with standardizing your wake up times, and then the falling asleep will eventually follow. It'll kick in later.
Follow in line.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about sleep apnea? Does that, I mean, the reason why I ask is for some reason over the last few years, I've been seeing so much in, you know, the media, as well as just even, you know, when I'm driving around, I see so many sleep clinics opening up, et cetera. And that was never there when I was growing up ever. Does that affect your sleep? And what the hell is this all about? Part of me is like, I don't know. I've had some issues. We'll get into that in a second, but, this sleep apnea thing bothers me. Is it really, truly real? Is it something that needs to be addressed? What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It has to be addressed. If you want to, you know, live a longer life and have a better quality of life. So with sleep apnea, what's happening is, for whatever reason, and it's different reasons for different people, but with sleep apnea, what happens is the airway at nighttime collapses and closes. So usually when we're younger, our airways, like our physiology is such that we don't have this problem. Some people do, based on the way that we're built, but usually it's when we get older. Our airways have more troubles keeping themselves open when we're asleep, and they close in on us. For some people, it's partial, so it might just narrow to the point we're not getting enough air. For some people, it closes completely. So with sleep apnea, you would diagnose sleep apnea only with an overnight sleep study, because they monitor your brain waves, your muscle movements, your airway. So with sleep apnea, if you stop breathing 5 times per hour on average throughout the night or more, they would diagnose you with sleep apnea. And there's mild, moderate, and severe. And at the severe end, I think it's over 50 times per hour. So if you imagine breathing at least once per minute, and you're stopping breathing for at least 15 seconds. Sometimes people stop breathing for a full minute before they wake up, their brain wakes up, and they start breathing again. So with sleep apnea, you're really not able to get any refreshing sleep. It's very difficult. So you're going to be sleepy all day. There's going to be cognitive impairment during the daytime because your brain is not functioning as well as it could. So you're going to have trouble focusing, paying attention, or remembering things. You're not going to be alert. You're going to be dozing off a lot. So people with untreated sleep apnea, and the key is untreated. So if you're treating it, that's another story. But untreated sleep apnea, you have a much higher risk of motor vehicle accidents and cardiovascular disease. So your blood pressure is going to skyrocket if you're not treating your sleep apnea. So there's a lot of health consequences for not treating it.
Okay, so here's the thing. Do you have a question, CeeLo? Because I see you.
I was going to say, so with the sleep apnea, you get that CPAP machine, which helps prevent you from stopping breathing, which is fucking scary when you think about it.
It is.
What about, like, what's the difference, I guess, between apnea and snoring? And can you get a CPAP? Can you just go pick up a CPAP to help with snoring? Or do you need to do the whole sleep clinic study thing?
Yeah, the CPAP is a medical device, so it can only be obtained with a doctor's prescription. So you have to do the sleep study to get it.
Got it.
And the doctor will program the air pressure. So I have sleep apnea and I use a CPAP machine, and I have mild sleep apnea. So my machine is set, the air settings are set between 5 and 10. I forget what units they are, but the pressure of the air is between 5 and 10. So when I'm sleeping, it automatically detects if the machine detects if I've stopped breathing, and it'll put more air and more air whenever I need it. So when I wake up in the morning and I look, sometimes it's only gone up to maybe 7 or 8 throughout the night. Sometimes it goes all the way up to my maximum of 10. But for some people with severe apnea, their pressure ratings might be much, much higher. So they might go up to, like, I don't know what the max is, but like 20 or 30. So there's a lot of forced air kind of being pushed in to keep the airway open. You would need the sleep study to get it. Snoring is when your airway is partially closed. That's what the snoring sound is that your airway is closing to some extent. And it may not be to the extent that you would have sleep apnea, but generally the snoring is a sign that you might have sleep apnea. Yeah. So anyone that snores, I would recommend going in for a sleep study just,
like,
to be sure.
If it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, kind of.
So, yeah. Okay, that lends itself to what I was going to mention about my experience with this. So I had gone to, it was a prerequisite for surgery where I had to go for a sleep study to rule out sleep apnea. And so I did this sleep study thing. And I actually got diagnosed with sleep apnea. And so I was like, oh, okay, fine. So they prescribed that machine, the CPAP machine. And I took it home and I was actually very, like, excited about it. I was like, okay, great. And maybe this, I'm supposed to have better sleep, you know, blah, blah, blah. I used it the very first night and it overstimulated me for some reason. I was not able to fall asleep at all, at all. And then I said to myself, okay, well, it's my first night. Let me take the machine off. But at that point, I don't know what the hell happened, but I could not fall asleep at all. At all. Like, it's almost as if it overstimulated my brain to such an extent where I was not able to sleep. And then I tried the next night. So I literally went 24 hours without sleeping at all. And I couldn't nap the next day either. And then the next day I tried it again. The exact same thing happened. So now I was 2 solid days with no sleep. And now my panic attack started because I guess my brain wasn't functioning properly. And so, you know, I had gone to my doctor to basically say, listen, I have not slept in 2 days because I'm trying to use this stupid ass machine and I need like one sleeping pill, something to get me to have a sleep. So that way I can stop these panic attacks and then try again. Well, instead of being, you know, and this is, we'll do another episode. I think we need to do another episode, CeeLo, on bad doctors because I've got some stories.
Total.
I know, right? But so this particular doctor was like, no, I'm not prescribing you anything. And I'm like, look it. I need something, right? Because I'm not sleeping. She wouldn't do it. So I then went 3 days with no sleep. And at that point, everything started to just shut down, right? Like my brain was not functioning properly. And honestly, she started, my actual doctor said, if you don't use this, we're going to pull your license. So that started the panic even further. And at that point, I went to my dentist and I got them to prescribe me a mouth guard that I could use instead of the CPAP machine. But I'm going to be honest with you, Tyler, you know, that whole experience, once I was able to get over that insomnia and that threat, which triggered my PTSD of, we're going to pull your license. I don't even want to look at a CPAP machine. I don't want to have anything to do with it. It's left such a sour taste in my mouth that I'm just like, So maybe I should talk to you. Maybe I should book an appointment with you to figure this shit out. Maybe I need some CBT therapy. I don't know.
It's tricky, but I feel like there would be a lot of people in your shoes. So if you ever did a podcast on, say, sleep apnea and had had a couple guests who had different experiences, I've talked to a lot of people who have had similar experiences where they just can't get used to the machine. It feels like they're suffocating and it takes a long time for people to get over that. So for you, it sounds like maybe it was such a bad experience, you might never retry it.
I would love to treat it. But I am very nervous about trying it again because I don't ever want to go through that experience again. That was disgusting.
It's such a shame too, because for the most part, anyone that I know that has one or has used one is like, this is amazing. I feel like I've gotten such better sleep. I feel more rested. So, but it is scary when there's a threat over your head and you have a dick doctor.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, and CBT is really all about, partly about this. So there's the behavioral change that's involved in cognitive behavioral therapy, but there's also the cognitive part. So how are you seeing the machine? What are you thinking about the machine? What does it mean for you? What does it represent for you? That matters too.
A hospital. So, yeah. It's so funny that you say that. It reminds me of a hospital. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like being on a breathing tube or something. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So no wonder that activates anxiety. Like no one would be able to sleep if they suddenly felt like they were, you know, in an ICU unit, right? it makes perfect sense. Versus, you know, for a lot of people and for myself included, I kind of see it as this life-giving device, right? So I feel like without it, I'm just visualizing without it. Like even when I nap for a period during the day, or if I'm traveling and I didn't have my machine with me and I'm going a night without it, I get a lot of worries that immediately come to mind. Like I'm not going to breathe properly tonight. I'm going to wake up all night long. So for me, having that hose and knowing that it's kind of like giving me breath, it gives me peace of mind, and that allows me to relax and fall asleep. So that's a really good example of how you're thinking about the device itself is going to dictate your emotional response and your behavioral response as to, are you going to toss the thing aside and like take a sledgehammer to it? Or are you going to like hold it dear and make sure it's always with you?
Yeah. That's so interesting. I had one more question. Do you have more CPAP questions, Bo?
No, I don't. No, no, I'm good.
You're
good.
I think I'm done with that need to freaking thing.
Yeah, no, but what I think I might actually do is just research this just a little bit more and actually talk to my therapist as well, because maybe it is something I should explore. I don't know. We'll see. I'm not committing to it right now, but I'm more curious about it. That's for sure.
Yeah. I like the idea that Dr. Tyler said that, you know, you take it and you like hold it dear, like this is giving me air. Yeah. This is giving me a better sleep. I'm going to wake up feeling, you know, and changing kind of that perspective of that you have right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're like, you're not.
So one thing I will before CeeLo, I'm not sure if you're going to ask about other things aside from sleep apnea next, but before you do, for your listeners, if they wanted to assess their own risk of sleep apnea, there's something, it's called the Stop Bang questionnaire, and you can just Google Stop Bang and find it online. And it really, it's an acronym. And so if you go through this, there are 10, how many letters is Stop Bang? I'm counting on my fingers. 8.
Yep.
So there's eight criteria that you go through. And if you answer yes to whether it's 3 or more, 4 or more, 5 or more, it puts you in a different risk category. Mm-hmm. So there are things like, do you snore loudly? Do you often feel tired, fatigued, or sleepy in the day? Has anyone observed you stop breathing? Do you have high blood pressure? Is your BMI greater than 35? Are you older than 50? Is your neck size circumference larger than 16 inches? Is your gender male? So all of these things, the more things you...
CeeLo and I are pissing ourselves laughing because it's like, yes.
I don't have high blood pressure though. That is one thing.
I don't either. I don't either yet. Yeah.
And I'm not a guy. The Stop Bang questionnaire. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's all from me on sleep app.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Interesting. Okay. That's a good little tool. I was going to ask about like things to track your sleep, like Apple Watch, or I was listening to the Jan Arden podcast, and they were talking about Jan uses this Aura ring, and it's a ring that you can wear on your finger, and I guess it monitors your sleep for you. And she's like, every morning when I wake up, the first thing I do is check to make sure I'm above 82 or whatever the number is, and then she knows the minute she gets up if she's going to have a good score on this thing. And it's like become part of her routine of checking in on her sleep. But what about using tools like that to help kind of monitor your sleep for you? Do you think they're like pro or helpful?
Yeah, I think it depends on your relationship with your device. So if you wake up and look at your device and that creates anxiety for you, like if you look at it and think, oh my God, it's saying that I didn't get any deep sleep last night, and that gets your mind racing and makes you feel anxious, I would say it's not serving a helpful purpose, and maybe don't use it. That being said, I use, so I use, I track I make sure my Apple Watch is charged before bed so that I can track my sleep every night. And it is one of the first things I do when I wake up is look at the app on my phone to see what my sleep was like. For me, I find that it doesn't. Like, if I see I've got a bad night's sleep, I take it with a grain of salt and think, okay, well, I'll get a better night tomorrow. But if you're anxious about your sleep and you see that and that sends you into a spiral, right, then I would say maybe put it aside and don't use it. Also take it with a grain of salt too. Like, it's not that accurate. So if you think of the, is it Auto Sleep? I think it's called. So the one that I use on my Apple Watch, you have to calibrate it. And if you don't calibrate it properly, it's going to give you really wrong information.
Right.
So when I go in the morning, it's calibrated now, but when you're first starting to use it, you can go in and see your phone app will tell you. So based on what your watch detected last night, you got anywhere from 2 hours of sleep to 10 hours of sleep. So pick which one represents what you feel was most accurate. Yeah. So then you got to go in and say, I think it was this one. So once you've calibrated it and you've done it a couple nights in a row and you've zeroed in on kind of the reading that's right for you, then you can probably trust it a little better. But I think it's okay to kind of take what it's telling you with a grain of salt, because it's not always going to be entirely accurate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of cool though. I mean, I like the tech and the tools for stuff like that. So I was kind of curious. Mm-hmm. Although my watch is always dead by the time I go to bed anyway. So, right?
What's that telling you about your sleep?
Well, no, I mean, like, I have to plug it in. I wouldn't be able to wear it to bed for it to monitor me because it's already dead.
Yeah. Okay, one last question before we let you go, Dr. Tyler. So when it comes to the CBT, like the cognitive behavioral therapy, and for some reason, every time I hear CBT, I'm thinking weed. I don't, but that's THC, right? I don't know why.
CBD.
That's it. Okay, right, CBD. Okay, but the cognitive behavioral therapy. So how does that work to help insomnia? Like, what do clients, I guess, learn through doing this therapy? Like, how, and I'm specifically curious about, you know, from the sleep apnea perspective, how I might be able to use that therapy to maybe get me to try that again. But like, how does this help you have better sleep?
Yeah. Well, the idea really is with CBT is that there's a lot of things interconnected. So if we think of someone who has depression or anxiety, we know that we can't just solve the problem by telling them to stop being less depressed or stop being less anxious. But we know that our emotions are connected to other things, like our perspective, the way that we're seeing ourselves and the world and our future is tied into how we're feeling. So if we shift our perspective on something, still in a realistic and balanced way, like, the solution isn't to wear rose-colored glasses, but we also don't want to wear such dark shaded lenses that we're seeing the world in a skewed negative way either. So the idea there is to find a balanced perspective that we can take that's more helpful for us. So changing the way that we see and understand things can lead to feeling differently, and doing things differently can lead to feeling differently. And there's also this connection between doing things differently and thinking differently, which is also so everything's kind of tied in together, it's all bi-directional. And what's happening in our bodies matters too. So if you're feeling really tense, that might lead to more anxiety, just as feeling more anxious might lead to more body tension. Mm-hmm. So everything's kind of linked all together. So with CBT, applying it to insomnia, usually the first thing that I work on with people is the more behavioral change. So we provide education on, you know, factors like sleep drive, internal clock, that conditioned arousal we talked about, how over time you can pair your bedroom with stressful activities so that the bedroom kind of triggers that anxiety and stress all by itself. So once we provide that information, then we make the necessary changes to tackle the problem. So we get people to cut out napping. We get people to wake up at a certain time every morning. We get people to leave the bedroom if they're not sleeping. So they get out, even if it's three times a night for an hour each time, keep getting out of the bedroom and doing something to calm the mind. And when you're sleepy, get back in again. So we start with all of these behavioral changes. And then usually the next session, if there's some troubleshooting that needs to be done, we do that. And then we can talk about the cognitive part of things. So what can you do to calm the mind? So sometimes it's all about, you know, turning worries into problem solving. That's a big one for worriers. So worriers tend to focus on the problems that could arise that might be realistic the next day, But they might also think of any problem that could arise in the next 50 years.
Yeah. It may or may not happen. That's me. 100%. 100%. So I'm always 10 years ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So recognizing the utility of that, right? So how mm-hmm. useful is it? What does it do for you? What does it do for your emotions? What does it do for you physically in your body mm-hmm. to think about something potentially going wrong 10 or 20 years from now? Doesn't make any sense, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't make it easy to stop doing, but it's the first step is recognizing, okay, this worrying about this yeah. isn't doing anything for me. And then if I'm going to worry, I might as well worry about things that, you know, are more likely to happen tomorrow or this week. And then when I'm worrying about those things, rather than simply worrying that they might happen, let me take that a step further and then do a bit of problem solving so that I can actually do something about it. If your worries, you realize, are things that you can't do anything about, then it's important to just kind of note that to yourself and say, you know what, I'm worried about this. This is beyond my control. The outcome is not something that I can control at all. So I've got to put this on a shelf. And if there's anything that I'm worried about that I can control, let me put my efforts there instead and let me come up with a plan. So what is the next thing that I can do to tackle this? Even if it's, you know, Googling something tomorrow, I'll write that down, Google whatever, or mm-hmm. find the name of this clinic, or, you know, mm-hmm. put a phone call through to so-and-so. That's and just remind yourself that, yeah, so I've got a plan for tomorrow so I can let these worries go. I like to use the analogy of juggling. So when you're worrying a lot, it's like you're juggling. And you can't fall asleep if you're actively juggling things in your mind. So you've got to find a way in your mind to put those balls down and stop juggling before bedtime. And one way you can do that is to write all those worries out on paper. Not right before bed, but say an hour or two before bed. Write all the worries out. Recognize which ones are pointless to worry about and the ones that might have a point to worry about. Do that problem solving activity and That's see if that... idea.
Come up
brings a bit of peace of mind a bit.
Yeah, come up mm-hmm. with a little plan. It's kind of it just blows my mind that it's, you know, as I hear you talking about it, it feels so that makes sense. It sounds logical. Like it's just mm-hmm. okay, this I could do this. It's easy. It's something I can easily do. So it's such great advice and a bit of an eye opener for sure. I remember little saying that something like worry is like a rocking chair. Yeah, you can do it, but it's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I like that.
Like, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Maybe I just came up with it. No, I heard it somewhere. I'm sure I want to. You are so smart, Thilo.
So if you or your listeners are interested in putting these types of things into practice and want a bit more scaffolding than just listening to this podcast. So I'm going to recommend a book.
Yeah.
There's one called Quiet Your Mind and Get to Sleep, which is really a self-help book for managing insomnia based on all of these CBT principles. So I think that would be a great place to start. Quiet Your Mind and Get to Sleep.
Yeah. We'll put that in the show notes for sure.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of them out there. I know that that's a good one, but there's a lot of others that you'll find as well. I think Sink Into Sleep is another good one.
Okay. Perfect. This is really, honestly, great advice. And Dr. Tyler, honestly, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about this. I've actually taken quite a bit from this conversation, and I'm actually going to explore a little bit further, and I'm wondering if we might even need to bring you back for a part two at some point to kind of continue this conversation. I would also be interested in diving into a little bit more about the sleep apnea thing too. Yeah. So but we really appreciate your time.
Yeah,
for sure.
It was awesome.
It's been, thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. And I'm happy to come back anytime you'd like.
Yay. Super. Thanks, Dr. Tyler.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for taking a seat at the table today. We love our dinner guests.
Don't forget to subscribe and follow The Dinner Agenda on the podcast platform you use so that you don't miss any new episodes. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Dinner Agenda.
We look forward to hearing your comments, questions, and even ideas you may have on future episodes.
Thanks for taking this journey with us.